This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So my moniker is Mark Lancaster, and some of you I know, and some are new faces. I'm a Buddhist priest, and I live and work at San Francisco Zen Center. And I want to thank Reverend Miel for inviting me, and Hartford Street for inviting me. And good morning. My talk today is about Buddhist practice. Maybe more accurately, what is it? What is a Buddhist practice? The practice, you know, and why do we undertake such a thing? And what's appropriate in this study? What do you do when you study in this way? And what are its benefits? Now, usually we don't talk about benefits to practice. You know, we stay away from using that phrase, but I think you're mature practitioners, so you won't get stuck in the idea of any absolute independent or disconnected benefits, some place you're going to go to be benefited. In this language of the middle path, the language of this Buddha, Shakyamuni, you say benefits as a existent object aren't appropriate. It's not an appropriate way to really speak. Maybe you would say benefits or no benefits really aren't appropriate. Not an appropriate way for human beings to talk. And yet there are results. Resultants, things happen because of activity. So we study this process of this activity and what happens. And we don't do this in a theoretical way. We're quite connected to this activity. It's our life. Otherwise, it would be some distant thing, some curiosity. But this activity has effects also, how we experience it, and how we create it for ourselves. Now, the good news is the process has a pattern. It's not a series of random phenomenal events, mysterious events, separate from us events. And Buddha said, you know, this man Shakyamuni said, if you develop proper approaches to regarding or being part or seeing how you're part of this process and activity, you can benefit, you could say. He used the phrase, wholesome fruit will arise, which is actually a much more dynamic phrase than you'll be successful, which is, again, problematic. And I know you know we're not talking about success over here. But wholesome fruit arises from certain approaches. If we don't have some approach, some way of working with this situation, we can become even more confused. Our own pain and difficulty, our experience of pain and difficulty will begin to deepen in certain ways in this process that he's talked about. So, it's important too, I think, to know that he didn't disdain experience. And in fact, he trusted the experience of his life with certain approaches. In certain ways, he trusted these experiences that he had and that you have to give him true knowledge, to allow this arising of wholesome fruit to come about. We call that freedom, or joy, or happiness, true happiness. Although sometimes maybe part of our study is not only the process, but learning about true happiness. We have unusual ideas or distortions because of how we've gotten turned around about happiness too. So we're also studying our true happiness while we do this. So, if there were no pattern and no reliable process, just random events, this would be a terrible spectacle. You know, we would become Stoics or Jains, or take up heavy drinking. It's just an impossible situation. But some people, I think, believe that. That these are just random events. There's nothing, no pattern to them. We just have to do our best, survive another day. Sometimes, maybe for a little bit, things are pretty tough, but it's not a true insight. And then sometimes some people think, you know, I've got the pattern figured out. 54% of the time I can control it, you know, I can work this out, and I really don't have to really worry too much. I've got my approach set, my negotiation set, and I think that'll work. I've tried both of those. So one, you can end up a victim, and the other, there's sort of a disconnected tyrant. So the middle path is where in between do you relate to this process in a creative way to begin to see how it comes about. So he suggests that some activity on your own behalf, as you call your own behalf, is possible. An activity of what I wrote here, activity of intelligent awareness involvement. Activity of intelligent awareness involvement in this process is something that you can do. And it leads to minimizing this unsatisfactory pain or agitation. This fellow Shakyamuni said, all dispositions are suffering. All dispositions are unsatisfactory or have this nature or this quality. Now, he didn't say again all phenomena or dharmas are unsatisfactory or suffering. But again, our dispositions or the way we relate to this situation. We'll talk a little bit about dispositions today too. You probably know, but just as a refresher, dispositions are the fourth skanda or aggregate. The other four are form, sensation, perception, and consciousness. So the fourth slot is given to this forming body or aggregation body. Sometimes in pictures it's shown as a jug being formed, a clay jug on a wheel being formed, shaped continually. And he used, Buddha, or Shakyamuni, used this model of form, sensation, perception, forming, or consciousness, and that consciousness is a way of describing a process, our relationship to this process. It's a concept. So, and all five of these interact as long as you're alive or conscious. They're ceaselessly interacting. And they're not linear. They're dynamic. They're interdimensional, Inner being has been used too much, but totally dynamic in their aspect. Sensation, as an example, is prepared by our past dispositions, the effects that have happened in the past. We don't randomly sense things. We enter a room in our mind, our eyes, conscious, our eye is drawn to something, a certain person, a certain thing. So our sensations are formed also by how we're disposed or predisposed from past activities that we've laid down, how we've related to things in the past. These layers are built up. So sensation, I like that. Well, that's so good. Leads to perception, but also we've habituated our perception by certain sensation in the past and certain predisposition. So they come up also in a pattern. We can begin to see this arising, this wave-like quality. So I just want to set the stage that this is not five blocks separately happening, but it's life, it's animation. It's in the surround, like a ball, continually happening. It's pretty clear we don't experience everything at all times. We don't see everything in that way. We're not omniscient in that way, nor did the Buddha claim to be omniscient in that way. But we choose, based on the layers of these dispositions that have been built up over time, we're disposed or invested or attached to certain patterns, certain ways of things happening. And again, we can see how this predisposition affects us. We can begin to, doing certain things with certain approaches, begin to see, oh, there's a way this is all happening. It's not so mysterious after all. This intelligent awareness activity. So, pretty clearly, I think it's pretty clear, but it's taken me, I'm 63. you can't step out of these dispositions so simply. The problem is, without any dispositions, you would psychologically collapse into buzzing confusion, and all these events would lose any pattern again. They would be inconsistent. So some disposition is necessary. Some activity is necessary for sentient life. Our vow as bodhisattvas is to sustain and become, maybe we say, informed about the activities of these dispositions of life. So, which means we accept some agitation. You can't be alive without some agitation. Background vibration at all times, but you can, there's a volume switch with intelligent awareness activity. You can set the volume differently. You can relate to this differently. So as bodhisattvas, which are beings that commit to life, to being here together, in other words, accepting our situation as it is. Here we are. That's all I know. Born, here I am, 63, you know, still here. I'll just stay here where I am. So we do that and accept this, some agitation, but some commitment to inquire. So as a Buddhist or person who is interested in waking, or this awakening activity, or engaging in an activity like this. This practice begins with uprightness. It actually ends with uprightness, too. To be upright and balanced, stable in the face of this spectacle of ceaseless arising of dispositional attitude and activity and change all the time, all around us. We need to be somewhat upright and stable to do this. And somewhat soft, a little soft. Forbearance is really useful here. You don't want to add to the agitation that's inevitable, but you can have a little forbearance and realize this process is not so simple to see. This arising, this mirroring, or this spectacle is not so easy to relate to. So some forbearance, but you have to be upright, attentive. We call that living in the present moment. The disentangling can only happen right here, as the disposition and the distortions are coming up. You can actually see them. But you have to have the right approach. So we use uprightness. And we anchor with each other. We call that sangha. You know? It's important to have good spiritual friends to do this kind of work. We get overwhelmed. We get bewildered. I get bewildered. I get caught up in my interesting storylines. But the more stable I seem to become, the more I can see why I'm doing it. Oh, wow. Why do you have that critical thought? Oh, it feels good, actually. I feel stronger. I'm here. I'm me. there's some activity in there you can start to watch. So, even while it's happening, you can watch it. It just takes time, you know, because we've been trained differently. Our lives have trained us differently, so we're going a little against the grain of a lot of habit, a lot of habit energy. So, and of course, the dispositions that we create based on prior confusion creates another layer of dispositions. I was imagining saran wrap. You know, it's kind of filmy. And if you grease it, you can't kind of see through it. And then you begin to layer it. And you begin to layer it. It gets thicker and thicker. And then you look through it and you have, oh, this is how. And then you lay down another layer. So it kind of, it's cumulative. It's interpenetrating and cumulative as we lay down these dispositions. So, and then we come into a situation, you know, where this greasy film or this murkiness, and something happens. Usually, for us, it's another person, deeply irritating other person. And a process starts. More of the same. More of the same can happen. However, this is not an algorithm poised to run in an endless loop. This is the good news. If it were, we would just layer and run, contact and run, layer and contact and run. We would just repeat this endlessly over and over again, you know, like a crazy bad computer program. We have the ability, because of this insight, something, this, and also this teaching, to interact with this algorithm or this process creatively, even unexpectedly, ways that are unexpected. Again, this is dimensionality of dynamic life. You know, it has creative and unexpected features in it, not necessarily given if you just view them maybe extrinsically, but if you're in the process, we call people like Buddha and Christ rare flowers. They behave in unexpected ways in the midst of this process of laying down centuries of dispositions. They do something totally different. where kind of we call those miracles. How could that be? This person seems so free, you know. They just seem to walk right on water, you know. And it's okay. We need these models. You just have to be careful, you know. You don't want to make them too unique, unrepeatable. They're actually showing you something to do, this intelligence awareness activity. It's not a mystery. They didn't go anywhere else to get it, but they were quite subtle with this process themselves. And they did something. They interacted with it in a unique way. So, if you separate them and make them mysterious entities, then you go to church. Not that going to church is bad. Can be very invigorating, but they seem so special. It's an unrepeatable program that you probably can't run, so you can't do that. In Zen, we accent the activity at the expense of divinity. It's the activity of this intelligent awareness that we put our store in. Sometimes you hear that saying, if you see the Buddha on the road, kill him or kill her. So if you've created this external place you go to, you should not do that. Come back here into the process in a skillful way and engage in the activities of these, that these rare flowers have showed us. That's what they were trying to teach us. And, you know, during Buddha's lifetime, he said there were hundreds of his followers that were engaged in intelligent awareness activity, just like him. He didn't distinguish that way. So, I'm a special, not really. He said, oh, they're all around me. Like, you see how they act? Do you see what they do with their lives, their uprightness when they meet this? So, so, in Zen, we study precepts or uprightness in the face of the bewilderment of meeting these situations in our own dispositions, this layering. We cultivate stability and balance, kind of suppleness. We call that skillful. I gave a talk to a kids group, and I used a professional, a Vipassana teacher who works with professional athletes. And he said, you know, if you're, he said, professional athletes are the most frightened people he knows because their expectations are always high, the expectations placed on them are high, and they have a very small window with a lot of pain and, you know, a lot of performance anxiety. So they're always really anxious. But he with some Vipassana training, they can let that come up, but also seeing into the process, they can remain very flexible. They can keep their eye on the ball and move. They can relate to things as they're happening. Not their idea of the ball, but their idea of success. They just relate to the game. They get into the game. It's the best. Get in the game. So keep your eye on the ball. This guy's name is George Mumford. He's a pretty good teacher. So we keep our eye on the ball. And we have to practice a little bit. And, you know, we sit in rooms like this. To be upright, to be stable, to be a wall when this bewilderment, this errant kind of energy comes up when we're in the flux, like the eddy of our dispositions and our contacts. So we need to do this. And meditation helps. It's showing you the process of this experience and not being bowled over or not grabbing at something. A little bit. So in the midst of these dispositions, I was imagining it's like, you ever go to those fun houses when you were a kid, you know, and you look in the mirror and suddenly you're huge and then you're tiny. You know, we have these distorting qualities because of all the prior approaches that were somewhat flawed, the conclusions we drew, the intentions we brought. And we have this arising of these strange distortions of some sort of entity that seems to be independent or separate. Now the good news is those distortions aren't solid either. They're also conditioned. They're conditions that are affected and affect each other. So we can work with this self-distortion or self-view that comes up. So you have, you know, this process of contact, sensation. The Buddha said, "What we sense, we perceive," which is interesting. What we sense, we perceive. Perception is born in that moment, and what we perceive, we begin to reflect about. We mentally proliferate. We obsess about. We come up with ideas about what's happening that we believe in, these distorted selves, and we say, well, that's really it. And we become further bewildered and confused. So we sit first quietly, just be quiet in the midst of these changing conditions. Very important. With a lot of patience. And compassion for the pain that we felt when we've been bewildered by our experience. And the pain out here, too. We can see it in the people around us. So, I was imagining, you know, it's not like these... Now the good news too is these dispositions, each of these film sheets, they're not flat panels. It's like one film sheet doesn't change another film sheet. When you begin to see the distortion yourself, this self-view distortion, this funny distortion, you see the texture of the disposition, you have the feel. And then it opens up a little bit, you get a little space. That information goes through all the other panels, all the other film sheets simultaneously. So this activity actually is very powerful. It's not this one-to-one flat panel relationship. So even these simple moments of aha, of intelligent activity, awareness you have in meditation or you know, in the middle of being angry at somebody, and then you say, "Oh, I just feel diminished, so I think I feel angry and I'm scared." And you can have that, and you can have some look in there, and you can have some. But when you don't grab it, all the panels shift. All the panels get informed simultaneously. And maybe I'll end with has a little... I like this from David Lloyd. I like this book. It's a book called The World is Made of Stories by David Lloyd. He's a writer and thinker. Maybe I'll end on this note, and then we can ask a few questions and prepare for tea and cookies. So... He says, one meaning of freedom is the opportunity to act out the story I identify with. Another freedom is the ability to change stories and my role within them. I move from scripted character to co-author of my own life. A third type of freedom results from understanding how stories construct and constrict my possibilities. Whether or not karma is an unfathomable moral law built into the cosmos, living a story has consequences. The difference between good and bad karma is the difference between life stories that decrease and increase suffering. That difference is different from the difference between improving one's karma and realizing how karma works, which is free from karma. The most troublesome narratives attempt to secure and aggrandize an ego self understood to be separate from the rest of the world. Its supposed interests are pursued at the cost of others. Those efforts boomerang because such a discrete self is delusory, awakening or intelligent activity. Involves realizing that my story is part of a larger story that incorporates other stories as well. So, maybe that's enough on a hot, warm Saturday. It's pretty cold here. So maybe any question about this or anything else? Maybe a few questions, and then I guess we go up to the... Hi, Jennifer.
Hey, thank you for... I love this stuff. I don't know the question exactly, but...
or a statement.
Like the aggregates, the five aggregates are kind of like... They could be looked at as dharma gates also, because they're empty. There's this free play happening as the mind's contacting or anything like that.
Yeah.
There's this free play happening, but it's, as you said, it's like the self-clinging, that sense of self is interpreting it, so it freezes all the gates, or it's like your panel kind of in the future.
Oh.
And so it's not your antidote, but I'm just trying to see if I got this right. You said we can see how the conditioning, I'm not using the same language, rises. It's like the bigger sound, and you said they're all, the aggregates are all interacting kind of at once, kind of like quantum, not quantum physics. So there could be enlightened activity too when you don't have the self clinging.
Mm.
And those are separate.
Mm.
These are just words because it's not something. Anyway, it's not really a question, I'm just trying to sketching off a little bit of what you said.
It's good. I like the way you said it. It's a development from what I said. But yeah, this is... in aversion blossoms fall, and in... Is it in aversion blossoms fall, and in desire weeds spread? Can you remember?
Attachment
weeds spread. This is our life. This is where we live. You know, where else would this intelligent activity awakening occur in the midst of this? My Zumi said, so what's wrong with weeds? Myriad life forms abound in weeds. Where else would you be? So then we come back into the activity.
Weeds have a lot of energy.
There's energy.
Yeah.
There's energy.
Very prolific.
However, everything has results and consequences, so we need to pay attention, that's all. Pay attention to what these different aspects are doing. So we come back to blossoms falling and weeds spreading. You know? I think somebody... Anyway. Maybe that's enough. Is that enough? Yeah. Yeah. Yes?
I have a question, please.
Yeah.
These days, where I'm placing most of my attention is how I move in the world based on, or as it relates to, how I feel about things that come up. And I read a story the other day in a book about a monk following the Buddha, whom he had never met before. He had traveled to meet the Buddha, and he was asking the Buddha for a teaching, And after asking him several times, the Buddha turned around and said something to the effect of, in the seen, only the seen, in the tasted, only the tasted, in the smelt, only the smelt. And the author of the book that I was reading was indicating that what the Buddha is trying to say here is that in experiencing the seen or the tasted or the smelt, that what happens then is that you have the capability of forming an idea about it. Mm. So in backing up, I think that the point is that this could be the danger point, is you've got phenomenon, you experience it, then you've got an opportunity to develop an idea about it. I like this. I don't like this. And then, therefore, for me, based on I like this or I don't like this, then I have an opportunity to act or do something. And that's where, in my life these days, I'm looking at, what am I going to do? What am I not going to do? And so I'm just wondering if I'm understanding this, and how it might relate to what you're talking about here.
It is. It's very similar in a way to Jennifer's question, you know. I mean, so you have events, phenomenal events, discrete events, but we experience them all through these aggregates, sensation, perception. We form things. So there's maybe a tipping point between existence and non-existence, between is there such a thing as just pure phenomena without any sentiency? It's an interest. Does a tree fall in the woods? Well, I would say, from a Buddhist perspective, it has no relevancy, the question. We come back again to the experiential realm that we're involved in. That's all we have to work with, these sense gates. And I can only tell you my experience that they come up so that first I see an experience, and then I see a self, and then I see a distortion. I see the oily smear, the murky quality. And I see some clarity. And they can all come up the more I'm stable and I can sit with it. They become clearer. Parts become clearer how they're interacting. So you get maybe more ability then to move through things or to choose. The other place you would say would predispose one to stepping out of karmic responsibility of being totally free or totally objective. I think it's neither free or not free, this place Buddha's talking about. That's why it's a very interesting place. And there's a very famous koan by Bhajan and the Fox, you know, where Bhajan is asked, does a Buddha, is he bound by karma? Is he bound by condition? He says, no, Buddha is free. That becomes a fox for 500 years. And then he meets later Bhajan, and he says, hey, can you help me? I'm kind of stuck here. I've been a fox for 500 years. And later Bhajan says, Buddha is not indifferent to this process. He's very informed about this process. And then it becomes a he transforms again. But there's a trick in here. Again, foxes are beautiful creatures. There's a koan and a koan here to look at. Do you disdain the fox life? So, it's a paneled koan about karma in this question. So, stay really close to this process. You are the process. More than we know, we are the process. The seeing, the hearing, the tasting, the touching, the self-view, the clinging, the distortion, the letting go. And it gets clearer. It does get clearer. and we make better choices. We make better and better choices. I've been there before. And then each choice has effects that go and go and go, changing lots of these panels, these dispose of these mirror dispositions at the same time. That can seem miraculous to us when there's a shift like that. We say it's in the body. It's not so much just in the mind. So if you try to do it that way, you'll think that you can control things. So it's neither controlling things or not controlling things. Again, the middle path. It's neither birth nor is it death. These are inappropriate and excessive statements. As existent entities, they don't. It's not in the true statement. You can't talk that way. We talk that way. Of course you can talk that way. But it's not so good to talk that way. Unless you have to be careful. So, don't disdain the weeds when you're in the weeds. Don't disdain, you know, the fox when you're the fox. Be informed and appreciate. Now, it's 11. Maybe that's enough for today. Shall we prepare to the upper chamber? Thanks.